I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A certain British prime minister, some steadfast journalists tracking down a story, and a ruthless hit woman are all in town this weekend at area theaters. Today, our indie foreign and documentary film critics are here to tell us which plots and performances go beyond standard Hollywood fare. What about a hard-charging mother and an abusive companion who drive a figure skater to the brink, or a set-in-his-ways dressmaker who has his life upended by love? Well, the critics will give us a thumbs up or down on those two. And we'll look at the awards season, including those films recognized by the KC Film Critics Circle. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's movie awards season, which means two things: lots of red carpet on Sunday nights, and lots of terrific films released at year's end, which has become something of a holiday, a Hollywood tradition. Today, our film critics are in the house to preview the Oscar nominations coming out next week and to critique the independent films now showing around town. Our critics, film professor Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Savvy veteran critic Steve Walker. Steve,
well, thank you. I like that.
And Bob Butler, the longtime movie reviewer for The Star. You can read his reviews at butlercinemascene.com.
Good morning.
Welcome back. Yeah. Okay, it's awards season. What's coming up, Cindy, on the calendar here? What's
well,
next?
Well, it's something anticlimactic called the Oscars.
Yes.
I think we've already heard every acceptance speech from every actor and director. I just think things have, well, it's disappointing to me that the best award show seems to be the Golden Globes now, and they've stolen the thunder from the people attending the Oscars.
Well, why is it better? The Golden, I watched,
well,
the Golden Globes too.
It's a lot looser. TV,
yes,
actors and shows,
it's usually
are involved.
Looser, but their outreach and their female empowerment efforts and all the black costumes, I thought it was very moving. The most moving award show I've probably ever seen.
And Oprah's speech.
More appropriate for the Golden Globes than for the Oscars, I would say. Humphrey Bogart said he had a good idea. The only honest way to find the best actor would be to let everybody play Hamlet and let the best man win.
Hmm.
What do you think? Oh,
there you go.
But I just want to make the point again. The only one that really does matter ultimately is the Oscar.
Well, is the Academy of Motion Picture, I forget the whole
Arts
name.
Arts and Sciences.
Are they worried about this notion that maybe they're seeming to be the not doing as well as the Golden Globes?
I don't think they're worried. I think the only thing that has come up in the last couple of years is the hashtag Oscars so white, when they couldn't manage to nominate anyone of color. And I don't think that will happen this year.
The other point I want to make is that with over 300 movies released in the United States in the course of 2017, they're the same 12 movies that are being nominated for Best Picture.
That everyone touts here.
Same 12 actors.
And what's your issue there?
Well, surely there's another way to deal with this, and I don't have any magic answer, but I think that a lot of the people who are sent these advanced copies of the movies are working individuals who don't have time like we have to sit down and watch 100 movies. I mean, we really do during the award season. Watch dozens and dozens. And so when they see an award show announce, you know, Gary Oldman as Best Actor, they'll probably, out of their stack of screeners, will say, well, I guess I ought to watch the one with Gary Oldman, or I ought to watch, you know, Call Me By Your Name. We ought to watch this or that. And they don't really give a fair shake to the other movies that haven't been touted, distributed.
So the issue here is a certain groupthink takes over, and the people who nominate and pick the Oscar winners aren't really watching all the films, sort of like lawmakers passing bills without having read them.
Yeah, I think so, too. I would disagree with Cynthia only to the extent that, as Bob said before the show, the cream rises to the crop. And here in Kansas City, for our Critics Awards, you had 28 very different people all submitting nominations independently to one person who tabulated them, and we get to our nominations at the day we vote, And it's the same nominations as the Globe.
Yeah. Now,
and the Screen Actors Guild. So these are performances that are worth mentioning, and that's what happens.
Well, so the question here, though, Cindy, is if, you know, because of this groupthink, are there films that you would have nominated for Best Picture that haven't been nominated, or do you agree with the picks that are being made here, generally speaking?
Well, I think the ones that have been selected or championed or promoted by their distributors and their studios are worthy of awards. They really are. So
I'll be brutally honest. There are movies, little movies, that I would consider for Best Picture, but I shake my head and I say, no one's heard of it. No one's seen it.
No one's going to go.
Why should I bring it up?
No,
Well, that's a problem.
It
though,
is. And I say this with guilt, but I know that's an overwhelming thing in doing the Kansas City Film Critics Circle's list. Every year, there's something I'll look at and I'll go, oh, man, I really ought to. And then I kind of defer to something that I know everybody's seen.
I've done that myself. I have. Now, the awards show that we, well, it wasn't broadcast. It was at California's
for the most part. Yeah,
yeah,
no,
so
broadcast.
No one dressed
no red
up.
Carpet.
But it was the 52nd annual James Lutzenheiser Awards. Who was
James? He was a psychiatrist, actually, who founded the Kansas City Film Critics Circle way back 52 years. You say,
wow.
In fact, I believe the Film Critics Circle is the oldest municipal-based film critics group in the country.
Okay. And also the Vince Kohler Award for the year's best sci-fi horror fantasy film went to Get Out. The Dr. Tom Poe Award for the year's best LGBTQ film, Call Me By Your Name.
One of my former colleagues at UMKC, and everybody misses Tom Poe, that's for sure. So which one, Best Picture, and tell us about those awards?
Best Picture was Get Out.
Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting because I don't think that's going to be repeated in the... It'll be nominated probably.
It will.
But,
yeah.
You know, here's... It is going to be called a horror movie. Well, on one level it is, but it's also a piece of incredible social commentary. And I think Hollywood doesn't like things that are two things at once. It confuses them.
The plot line for Get Out is what, in a sense?
A young black man and his white girlfriend travel to upstate New York to visit her parents, who seem to be wonderfully liberal folk. It turns out that's not exactly the case.
Mm, okay.
The Robert Altman Award for Best Director went to Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water.
Okay.
And the Best Actor, Timothy Chalamet.
Chalamet, who we'll talk about today for Call Me By Your Name.
Right. Yep. Best Supporting Actor, Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project.
I get that.
Best Actress, Sally Hawkins for The Shape of Water. Best Supporting Actress, Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird. Original Screenplay, Get Out. Adapted Screenplay, Call Me By Your Name. Best Animated Feature, Coco. Best Foreign Language Film, In the Fade, which we'll be showing here in Kansas City soon.
Which you should put on your calendar. It's an amazing movie.
Absolutely. And Best Documentary Feature went to Jane.
The Jane Goodall film, right?
Right.
Which I missed at the Tivoli when it was here. And we're talking about all this because, next Tuesday, the Oscar nominations come out, and that'll be obviously a very big deal in the film
the
world, right?
And then the Oscars will be March the 4th.
Seems late to me, but... Yeah. What do I know?
One other point, though, too, and I hear this every year. I have so many friends who say, nobody's ever seen this movie. How did it get on a list of the 10 best films of the year? I mean, we could talk about Lady Bird. It's a very low-budget little film right up there.
It's doing very well,
it's
though.
Got a good buzz, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I sort of think there's an issue here with these awards if some films that are worthy are sort of being overlooked because... People are thinking, well, no one's going to mention this film because no one's seen it.
There's a difference between worthiness and momentum. Mm. And momentum, I think, is at least as important as worthiness when it comes to some of these big awards.
Okay, so maybe these Oscars deserve a big asterisk next
there
to
you
the
go.
Winners. That's what we're talking about here.
Sort of like the record of the team that 10 years later lost the championship because half their players were ineligible.
Right,
that sort of
right.
thing, an asterisk by it. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to some films that have just opened here, and let's mention the film that Steve Walker just alluded to, Call Me By Your Name. It's a coming-of-age drama set in northern Italy featuring an American doctoral student and his professor's son who are drawn to each other.
This is probably the only love story of the year that I can even think of. Timothy Chalamet is 22 years old, and he has been nominated for Best Actor. He won our critics group. He'll get an Oscar nomination for his performance as a 17-year-old kid, very smart, son of a professor, who falls in love with his father's grad student who comes to Italy for 6 weeks, played by Armie Hammer, and his character's age is 24. And they fall in love, and they realize under the clock there's 6 weeks. It is beautiful, heartbreaking, written by James Ivory, I want to say, from Merchant Ivory.
Adapted
by him from a novel by Andre Asiman.
Who, of course, made Mr. and Mrs. Bridge here in Kansas City.
Right.
And how did that work, Steve? You read the book.
I did
read
the book.
And how does the film compare?
Well, the movie's beautiful. The book set me up for it. I was very curious about this story. And the book, for people who care and want to read the book, it goes into their 40s.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, they're only 7 years apart, but when you get to be 43 and 50, you're colleagues, basically.
That's true.
People have been saying that there's going to be a sequel, that there are 50 pages at the end of the book that are not depicted on screen, and there's that jump forward in 20 years, so we may see a
I'd like to bring up something here that I think is really important. This is a movie about a gay relationship.
Yeah.
Calling it a gay movie, I think, is a miserable reduction of what is a really almost an epic emotional experience.
Right.
It's about families. It's about parenting. It's about a languid summer in Italy. I mean, right there, you've got some pretty wonderful stuff going on.
Yeah.
It's about coming of age. It's about discovering your sexuality. It's about not being quite sure what your sexuality is. It's got all of this
and
stuff
about
going
not
on.
Having to label yourself.
Exactly.
Among other things. We just want to say that it opens today, finally. It's been out in big cities for a while.
But I should point out that The Shape of Water had a romantic angle to it, too, so maybe this isn't the only.
No, it's not the only. I said it may be the only.
Okay.
But it's the one that moved me.
This is my choice for the movie of the year. So
is that right?
Yeah.
I just want to tell Luca Guadagnino is the director, just to mention him, because he put it together. And I want to say that if you're going to go see it this weekend, stay till the last scene, till the screen goes black, because in the last 3.5 minutes, there's an uninterrupted take of Timothy Chalamet revisiting his past 6 weeks. And it explains why he's nominated, and the whole movie is in his face.
Is this your film of the year?
No. Okay, it's a wonderful movie, though. I loved it.
What's the clip we have here from Call Me By Your Name?
Armie Hammer and Timothée Chalamet as Elio and Oliver and Elio talking about the weird boundaries that they're investigating the fluidity of.
Again, this is from Call Me By Your Name.
I don't want you to regret anything. And I hate the thought that maybe I may have messed you up. I don't want either of us to pay for this.
No, it's not like I'm going to tell anyone. You're not going to be, like, in any trouble.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Are you happy I came here?
I'd kiss you if I could.
Okay.
I haven't heard Cynthia's take on it.
Oh, I thought it was a wonderful film.
Okay,
I really, really liked it. I wouldn't consider my favorite movie of the year, but the performances were outstanding. Michael Stuhlbarg
plays the kid's son, the father.
Yeah, he has one of the best monologues in movies this year. It's about a 3-minute thing toward the end of the movie, and it'll leave you in tears. It's wonderful.
The last 15 minutes will knock you out. Over.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Bold words and things to look forward to here. That's our critique. 3 thumbs up for Call Me By Your Name. It's playing at the Tivoli, the Fine Arts Theaters as well. Okay. Steve, another film you wanted to talk about here that has some buzz because it involves Daniel Day-Lewis. This film is titled Phantom Thread. It's about a fashion designer and his young muse exploring love and working in the film that Daniel Day-Lewis has contended will be his last.
Well, let's hope not, but that it's not his last based on this performance. It's set in the 1950s. Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed it, who people know from There Will Be Blood, another great Daniel Day-Lewis character. He's a very neurotic, high fashion designer who lives with his sister, who is icy perfection in their strange relationship. And he meets this woman who's at a little hotel.
Little tea room off on the coast.
She's a waitress from another European country.
Kind of a bumbling waitress.
Yeah. He just sees her and is like, in his head, she is the person who needs to be wearing my clothes.
Which is ironic because he's been dealing with, you know, these svelte, you know, skinny fashion models. And here's this woman who's basically kind of earthy. She's got sort of a peasant stock thing going.
And he's dispensive of people. One of the first scenes is some woman at the breakfast table not being able to communicate with him. Obviously, they've been dating or something. And then his sister later says, do you want me to get rid of her? And we don't mean kill her, but we do mean, yeah, she'll get rid of her.
This is a guy who is so, he's so effete, he's so locked into his own thing that he lives his life by rituals. Even to the point that having a newcomer at the breakfast table chewing toast loudly drives him over the edge. In one of the funniest scenes this year, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so what else do you think about it, Steve?
I just thought it was beautiful. The clothes are beautiful. The pacing is really on point.
It's a mix of romance and black comedy at the same time, which is a very hard thing to pull off.
Mm-hmm. And it's him. You watch him and his face. It's a very quiet performance, but he's trying to... I really kind of love this woman, but I'm not used to people being in my space, being in my house. You know what I mean? Just... And he's working to open himself up a little bit.
Yeah.
If this is truly Daniel Day-Lewis's final film, what's his sort of place in Hollywood acting?
He's the only male actor to have ever won 3 Oscars, for one.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I had forgotten that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From My Left Foot, Lincoln, and There Will Be Blood. He's a great character actor, for sure.
He's more than a character actor. He's almost maniacal in his devotion to his... When he was doing Last of the Mohicans, he is now one of 3 people in the world who can load a flintlock rifle while running full speed. I mean, it's like, come on.
And make a canoe, too.
Yeah,
I think
right. It's just amazing.
Is he worthy of all kinds of acclaim?
He absolutely is. There are times when I thought he's almost so into it that it makes me uncomfortable.
He
pushes the edges, but I think it's good to be uncomfortable at movies.
He doesn't fill me with warmth.
No.
Because his characters don't.
No.
I mean, and maybe that's the key to his success.
What's the clip we have
the
here from Phantom Thread, Steve?
Daniel Day-Lewis talking about his relationship with his sister, Cyril, as he's explaining him and her's relationship to Alma, the woman he meets in the restaurant.
Cyril is right. Cyril is always right. It's not because the fabric is adored by the clients that Cyril is right. It's right because it's right. Because it's beautiful. Maybe one day you'll change your taste, Alma.
Maybe not.
Maybe you have no taste.
Maybe I like my own taste.
Yes, just enough to get you into trouble.
Perhaps I'm looking for trouble.
Stop.
No one's ever pushed him like she does.
Is he creepy?
No. He's just
you know
erotic.
What? I'm gonna challenge you there. I'm not sure we're meant to like him. I think he's at one point he says he will never marry because it would make him a monster, as if having relationships with women and then having your sister get rid of them isn't monstrous on its own.
That's true.
You know, so.
But Steve and Bob, you like this film.
I liked it a lot. And then you could tell a little bit of the score, how beautiful and lush
it's,
that
it's,
is.
It's a very interesting blend of moods.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our survey of some of the best independent films showing around town. We'll get to Small Town Crime, Proud Mary, The Post, I, Tonya, and a whole bunch more, including some that I've seen. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we talked about a current concern in public health, loneliness. And a woman shared what she learned from confronting her whiteness and the privileges that come with it. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, the doctor is in, the pet doctor, that is, our expert in all things animal, Wayne Hunhausen, returns. He'll have tips to keep your furry friends healthy and healthy during this very cold weather, plus a conversation about manipulation, control, and the so-called gaslight effect. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're talking with our film critics. They are Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Let's keep the momentum going here, guys, and let's turn to a film, Small Town Crime, Cindy. It's a low-budget crime thriller featuring an alcoholic ex-policeman who finds the body of a young woman on the side of the road and is determined to find her killer.
And stars one of my favorite actors, John Hawkes. I was trying to come up with the genre to describe this film, and it's sort of a neo-noir, melodramatic, contemporary Western, sort of in the tradition of No Country for Old Men or Hell and High Water, but on a much, much smaller budget. It was written and directed by brothers Isham and Ian Nelms, and stars John Hawkes, who was perfectly cast as an irreverent policeman, ex-policeman, Mike Kendall, looking for a killer and redemption and finding nothing but trouble along the way. And in the process, he puts his own family in danger. Hawkes is currently in Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. He plays Charlie, the ex-husband of Mildred, Frances McDormand's character. That'll be a trivia answer
years from now.
But I remember first seeing him in Winter's Bone in 2011 as Teardrop. He was nominated for an Oscar for that performance. And also he played the cult leader in Martha Marcy, Mae Marlene, also in the same year. Terrific actor. And I'm glad he's given a chance to do this. I wish it had a higher profile. I wish it got more attention. If you're interested in this sort of film, Hawks has found the perfect balance of being a wise guy and a sympathetic loser. And the rest of the well-cast ensemble includes Octavia Spencer, who plays Kendall's foster sister. And Octavia Spencer was executive producer on this film. And something is happening. Women, you know, talking about women in Hollywood, more and more of them are finding that the route up the ladder is as a producer or executive producer of a film. And that's what Reese Witherspoon is doing. That's what Octavia Spencer is trying to do with this film. And also we'll see Taraji P. Henson was doing this with Proud Mary. So it's...
How violent is this film?
It is, but again, with a sense of humor. I mean, not justifies it necessarily. But there's a good ensemble cast that, you know, sort of tempers the car chases and the shootouts.
That's terrific. John Hawkes is wonderful in this movie.
I think he's a lot better than the rest of the movie, to be honest with you.
No, that's fair. Yeah,
it struck me as a kind of. These filmmaking brothers kind of want to be a Tarantino, Shane Black kind of thing, but they're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. A lot of the things in this feel to me recycled rather than original. But I certainly didn't dislike it.
No, he's worth seeing for sure, and it's playing at the Screenland.
So how many thumbs up do we have here for this film?
It's on my three to see this week, absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to give it, I'm giving it a C+, which doesn't make us three to see in this week.
No, it's not very good.
Cindy, what's the clip we have, Cindy?
John Hawkes' character is talking to Octavia Spencer's character and to her husband, who is played by Anthony Anderson.
This is from the film Small Town Crime.
I got to him. Rattled his cage. He said her name was Christy.
He got a name. That's good.
So that's him. The killer is on that phone.
I don't think he knows she's dead. It's probably a pimp. Could be her boyfriend. Depends on how screwed up this girl was.
Wait, you brought a pimp into our house?
Oh, babe. It's a phone, Kel.
With my babies in the next room.
I didn't invite the guy to dinner.
You shouldn't be fiddling around with some dead girl's phone.
This guy is key to the investigation. He knows the girl, might even know who she was with that night.
You need to give it to the cops.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm gonna give it to the police.
Okay, look, Mike. I think what Kelly is trying to say is that you are no longer a cop.
Don't tell me what I'm trying to say.
I know I'm not a damn cop. Thank you very much, Teddy.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to bed.
Okay, from Small Town Crime and some fairly positive comments from at least two of our critics about Small Town Crime. Okay, Cindy, let's move on to a film titled Proud Mary. It's a hit woman working for an organized crime family in Boston, has her life turned around when she crosses paths with a boy during a botched hit.
Well, I'll just say it's not Atomic Blonde, although in the previews they do show her wielding numerous guns and in various shootouts. It's a shame. This is another movie that has just been buried. There were no press screenings. There were no opportunities to see the film in advance. I saw it in a movie theater, which is my go-to when we don't have to have a chance to see a film, you know, as film critics. But anyway, Taraji P. Henson plays this hit woman, and she plays Cookie on Empire. Mm-hmm. And this is her chance to start breaking into the film business as a producer. The movie contains elements of the movie Gloria, if we can remember that.
Yeah, the little Cassavetes.
Right. Also, The Professional. But it just, it has a lot of flash, a lot of style. Filmed in Boston, but it's not a great, what am I trying to say?
I did not action, see it, so I'm not sure.
A particularly memorable action film, but it wasn't as bad as some movies I've seen that have been promoted to the sky. It's called Proud Mary, and of course we'll hear Ike and Tina Turner play the theme song. I think of the opening.
Well, that's a reason to go see it, maybe by itself. Yeah.
So there.
Okay. That's the film Proud Mary. Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with our art, independent, and foreign film critics. Let's move on to a film near and dear to my heart. It's titled The Post. It's set back in 1971. The Post is a procedural about the Washington Post race to publish the Pentagon Papers, which were classified documents that revealed a secret history of the Vietnam War, Bob.
Directed by Steven Spielberg.
Yes, it is.
Who, in my opinion at least, guided us expertly through a complex story that begins in the jungles of Vietnam and ends up in the Supreme Court with a big argument about the Second Amendment. Talk about timely. The fact that we now live, we have a president who screams fake news whenever any criticism is directed his way. Mm-hmm. Nixon was almost as touchy, but not quite. Things about this movie I love. Well, for starters, it's a feminist-themed film because of the presence of Meryl Streep as Katharine Graham, the head of the Washington Post at the time the Pentagon Papers scandal was breaking.
And Meryl Streep is just dropped
dead. She's
extraordinary
terrific in
this film.
And I had seen Katharine Graham speak at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Read her book, loved her book.
Yeah.
Streep's got her voice. There's certain vocal inflections that Streep did her homework like she always does.
Well, here's a woman who basically inherited her role as a newspaper magnate because her husband died.
Yes.
And the men who surround her, when she goes to a meeting,
she's
the only woman in the place.
Those scenes are something
And these
else.
Men are patronizing. These men diss her behind her back. They call her weak and vacillating. And truth is, she is a little bit out of her element as this film begins. By the time it ends, she has to make a decision. Do they go ahead and print the Pentagon Papers in the pages of the Washington Post, even though it may scotch a deal to go public with the newspaper, even though it might mean a jail sentence, even though it might mean, well, a dozen things. And in that sense, it's about a woman discovering her voice and her bravery. Pretty awesome.
Did you catch her just at that pivotal moment in her life when she's just taking over the paper and she's a little unsteady?
Very unsteady in the early... Now, I think I know Steve agrees with me. Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley, and I was underwhelmed. My Ben Bradley is from All the President's Men.
Well, of course.
He's played by Jason Robards.
Forever.
Tom Hanks is almost too. The nice guy keeps bleeding through here. And I wanted a Ben Bradley who was a bit of a bulldog. You know what I mean?
Hanks is completely miscast. Doesn't ruin the movie. I didn't love the movie.
He was on the verge of ruining the movie.
On the verge.
Really? I was so put off with the way he looked, the way he stood, the way he spoke.
His accent comes and goes, and I hate that.
And I wish there had been more focus on the Katharine Graham character. Mm-hmm. I really do.
There was a lot.
And a lot less of Tom Hanks's version of Ben Bradley. I really do.
But you have to have the Bradley character in there who's pushing to make this monumental statement about the importance of the Fourth Estate in printing these papers.
But he's not an actor who can hold his own.
Hanks did
Meryl
not.
Streep.
Well, who can?
Ben Bradley was Katharine Graham's biggest fan.
Yeah, we've got a clip here, and this is when the Post reporters and editors are receiving boxes, secret boxes full of the Pentagon papers, and the pages aren't even in order. So you've got the voices you're going to hear here. You will hear Tom Hanks as Ben Bradley. Bob Odenkirk plays the editor and reporter who managed to get these from Daniel Ellsberg, the RAND Corporation analyst who swiped them from the Pentagon. Let her rip.
This is from the Post.
It's not the full report, but it's over 4,000 pages of it.
Huh. Are these in order?
I don't think so.
There are no page numbers.
Yeah, that's where the top secret stamps were. My source had to cut them off.
We're supposed to retire on Friday.
Ben, how are we supposed to comb through 4,000 pages?
They're not even loosely organized.
The Times had 3 months. There's no way we can possibly
get this. He's right. We got less than 8 hours.
We could shoot for City, then we'd have 10.
Hey, for the last 6 years, we've been playing catch-up, and now thanks to the President of the United States, who, by the way, has taken a all over the First Amendment, we have the goods. We don't have any competition. There's dozens of stories in here. The Times has barely scratched the surface. We have 10 hours till the deadline, so we dig in.
Mm. Steve, you saw the film.
I did.
And you rank it up there with All the President's Men? Or?
Yeah, I think it's just I thought it was terrific. I do not put it in the same Hollywood ground as All the President's Men. That's the all-time greatest journalism flick in my estimation. Spotlight, the best picture winner from a few years ago, is number two. This would be number three for me. A lot of people reporting to me that audience is clapping when this film comes to an end. Mm-hmm. And it's a reminder to all of us of the importance of newspapers and journalism and dogged reporting. And that's getting lost, I think, in this wild conversation we're having these days.
What about the people who work for the New York Times? How do you think they feel about the Washington Post here stealing their
What did the publisher of the New York Times said something like he's looking forward to the movie that talks about how we broke all the President's Men's the Watergate story. So no. But you get it. The film explains why the focus is on the Post as opposed to the New York Times, which did break the story and publish the first excerpts from the Pentagon Papers.
So
but this is you get why this film is made once you watch it and why the focus is on the Post.
But accurate history?
Well, now, there's a question. As far as I know, it is. But we're talking about this film, I, Tanya, about Tanya Harding here, and The Darkest Hour, our next three films, all of which raise questions, all of which are historical dramas, and all of which raise questions, at least in my mind, about am I getting the straight skinny here or not, and the obligation the filmmakers have to be pretty adhere closely to history when you're going back and depicting things that happened many years ago. And I wonder if the industry feels that same obligation, because I'm not convinced that it does.
Oh, no. Are you kidding? No.
But that's an issue, though.
Key number one is it entertaining? Whether it's factual, good, way down the list.
Well, and that's a big problem when you're going back talking about Winston Churchill and the Pentagon Papers, and even more recently, Tanya Harding.
Well, in the history of our own country, people know our history from movies, not from history books, not from letters, not from, you know, the facts. They know their history from movies.
Well, and that's concerning.
Yeah.
There's been something written about this, and Peggy Noonan had a great column a few weeks ago about this very point. And I'm sitting there in the middle of these films going, okay, this better be pretty true to life.
Well, if you want to introduce I, Tanya, I want to tell the listeners what it says on the screen before it starts. It's relevant to this conversation.
Okay, let's move on to I, Tanya. This is the dark comic drama about class and abuse and truth set in the world of ice skater Tanya Harding, who, of course, was accused wrongly of whacking Nancy Kerrigan's knee in the run-up to the Olympics.
Right, and relevant to your point, it says, quote, this film is based on an irony, based on irony-free, wildly contradictory, totally true interviews with Tonya Harding and Jeff Galooly.
So you get a sense that an attempt was made to be accurate here.
An attempt, based
well, but
on...
that's just it. It's based on interviews, people telling different stories, and the film represents that. Now, what's great about this movie is that for the last 25 years, Tonya Harding has been the poster girl for bad sportsmanship. You watch this movie and you realize, first, she had a rough, rough life. Second, we've probably gotten it wrong. That she's more or less blameless. Not totally, but...
Not totally.
But the film has an incredible tone. It's a black comedy. It was directed by Craig Gillespie, who made one of my favorite movies of all time, a comedy called Lars and the Real Girl, about a guy who falls in love with a blow-up, with a sex doll. Yeah. It was wonderful. Yeah, you know, who would have thought that would be heartwarming subject matter? It stars Margaret Robey, the... Australian, basically, let me face it, hottie, who is, you know, she did the bubble bath scene in what was the movie about the financial
Wall
system?
Street, yeah.
Wolf of Wall Street.
Wolf of Wall Street.
She is wonderful as Tonya Harding, who grew up with the mother, a mother who makes Mommy Dearest look like a walk in the park. Mm. Allison Janney plays her mother. Imagine a skull with a Beatles wig, smoking on a constant cigarillo with a bird on her shoulder, a filthy mouth, and an ego that will not stop. She pushed her little girl into skating. It's a story of class consciousness. The Hardings were white trash, and the skating establishment didn't much like that. You felt this... I found the film, I was torn between laughter and genuine sadness throughout this movie.
It was nominated in the Globe comedy category, but I have a good friend I watched it with who has been a therapist his whole career dealing with abuse victims. Mm-hmm. It was very hard for him to watch. He wasn't finding any of the comedy in there. It was just hit too close to home.
I understand that.
The film itself is, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No.
It's gotten a tremendous amount of press. There was a 5 or 6 page article with huge photos in the New York Times. And Gillespie, the director, actually located Harding and Galooly. They were both living in Oregon, not together. And interviewed them, and they had totally different stories about the incident and their involvement with Tonya Harding, mm-hmm. which made the film all the more interesting. Because
the incident is what they keep referring to the knee bashing that an acquaintance of Jeff Galooly's did. Tonya knew nothing about it before it happened.
You know, I thought this film was absorbing.
I did too.
It from the get-go.
I think it's an opera.
What I appreciate
it is.
Yes.
It
what
is
I appreciated
an opera.
About it is it breaks the fourth wall, and it totally flipped at least my perception, and I think a lot of people's perception, of Tonya Harding. You know, and if that's true to life, and again, some stories you realize after being a journalist for many years, you can never get to the bottom of, because there's so much, you know, contradictory information out there, people covering up for themselves and everything else. But, you know, if this story is anywhere close to true to life, you know, Tonya Harding deserves a national apology.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I agree with you.
It's just amazing.
She went from a very abusive, sick monster of a parent.
Yes.
Who we'll hear in a minute.
We are going
to
hear.
And to an abusive husband. And the abuse is not just hinted at. He pushes her head into mirrors, and he smacks her in the mouth. It's intense.
Yeah.
But it, and coupled with all the way the skating commission treated her, I mean, I'd be an enraged poor soul too.
Yeah. Basically, they thought, you know, you've got homemade costumes. We don't like your choice in music. You know, you're not a graceful, svelte creature. You're kind of a fire plug of energy.
Right.
And that just didn't meet their ice skating.
You know,
dreams.
Allison Janney plays her mother, and she will be nominated for Oscars and might win Oscars.
I think she already won a Golden Globe, didn't she?
She did.
Okay,
she's won
absolutely.
Awards,
this is our clip, and it centers on Allison Janney, so you'll get an earful here.
This is from I, Tonya.
I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonya Henney's mother loved her? Poor you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Bettys. No, I made you a champion. Knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice get you. I didn't like my mother either. So what? I gave you a gift.
You cursed me. You're a monster.
Spilled milk, baby.
I'm not sure if it's this scene or a later scene, but the scene where Allison Janney, as mom, can barely come to embrace her daughter
at
the moment of her greatest crisis, as she's facing the media and the story spinning out of control, it just breaks your knees.
It breaks my heart, because I've worked with abused kids myself in my other career, in my other field. We had to ask ourselves, not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you?
Yeah.
And I think that's the sad underlying tone of this film.
Yeah, yeah. But we need to give credit to Robbie.
Well, Robbie's great.
She did a phenomenal job. She did a lot of her own skating. She wore the same costumes, replicas of the costumes that Harding wore. There are reenactments and actual footage. Bottom line, too, as many things as this film is about, there's no such thing as the truth. Because you've got versions.
There's a Rashomon thing going on here.
And we have to remember, Tonya Harding was the first woman to ever successfully land a triple axel.
Which is portrayed very brilliantly in the film.
The skating scenes are incredible
because the camera's on the ice and you're seeing her from a different vantage point. It's just amazing.
It was such a moment of triumph because she knew that if it was all down to aesthetics, they were going to nail her. But if she did something no other woman had ever done, they could not ignore it.
Right. Yeah. And this is so timely as well. Last week, I guess, Ashley Wagner, one of the ice skaters who was going to go to the Olympics, came in fourth. She was furious with the judges. She said that to reporters on camera. Harding's style of living is to go up to them and say, "What the?
What are you doing to me?" That film again, I, Tonya, we're getting very strong reviews for
it,
right?
It's very good.
A terrific film. Okay. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the latest and best independent films now showing. Let's go to our last film that's now playing of the day. This film, another sort of historical drama, The Darkest Hour. It's a compelling history lesson about Winston Churchill in the days after his ascension to prime minister and his political battle with Parliament over whether to sign a treaty with Nazi Germany or fight to the bitter end.
Wow. Well, first, a confession. I have always found Gary Oldman to be a bit of a scenery chewer. However, he's playing Winston Churchill, who was pretty good scenery chewer in his own right, and the result is a marriage made in heaven.
Right.
One thing I have to mention, the unsung makeup artist who transformed Gary Oldman, wow, my jaw just dropped. After 5 minutes, you're not even thinking this is an actor. This is Churchill. So much going on here. Here's a man whose political career was thought to be dead and gone. He's dragged out of retirement with the collapse of the Neville Chamberlain government. He's faced with British troops stranded at Dunkirk, Germans rolling across Europe and planning to take over. And in fact, there were people in Britain who were ready to basically surrender to the Germans and say, "Come on down, boys." It's about 1 month, May of 1940, when the new prime minister, Winston Churchill, somehow has to get it all together. He has to turn this country around. There's one scene which I'm sure is absolute fabrication. It's corny, but it works. Winston Churchill gets on the London Tube, the first time he's ever ridden the subway in his entire privileged life, and starts meeting regular Londoners, people from the colonies, people who are kind of surprised to see the prime minister sitting there on the, you know.
I'm told that story is pure fiction.
I'm sure it is.
which again bothered me. We'll go back to that.
But it works. It did work. It symbolizes how he was able to rev up a nation.
Mm-hmm. There have been so many Churchills lately.
Late this year alone.
Poor Brian Cox starred in the movie called Churchill. This past year, Albert Finney, Michael Gambon, John Lithgow in The Crown plays Churchill. But no one compares for me to Gary Oldman. I want to make the point that if you've seen The Darkest Hour, you must see Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Because they are companion films. And Dunkirk, to me, is the best movie of the year because of the way it was photographed, constructed. Didn't need any dialogue. There's hardly any dialogue in the film. It is just brilliant. Something you could only do on film, directed by a brilliant filmmaker.
You know, don't shoot me for this, but my problem with Darkest Hour, and the filmmaker dealt with this early on, was simply the fact you have trouble understanding what Winston Churchill is saying. Mm-hmm. He was known for mumbling and sort of speed talking, which I guess is the way he was in real life.
But there were
times, even by the end of the movie, I didn't know what he was saying.
Here's a clip, with him talking with the outgoing Neville Chamberlain. Let's listen and see if we can understand what he's saying.
From The Darkest Hour.
There's nothing heroic in going down fighting if it can be avoided. Nothing even remotely patriotic in death or glory if the odds are firmly on the former. Nothing inglorious in trying to shorten a war that we are clearly losing.
Losing! Europe is still...
Europe is lost. And before our forces are wiped out completely, now is the time to negotiate in order to obtain the best conditions possible. Hitler will not insist on outrageous terms. He will know his own weaknesses. He will be reasonable.
When will the lesson be learned? When will the lesson be learned? How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased? Good God, given him mixed privileges before we learn. You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth.
That was a great line. And, I understood that, by the way. Just for the record, I could understand what he was saying.
Yeah.
Okay. But still, strong thumbs up for Darkest Hour. Right?
I think his performance is commanding. Yeah. I really do.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. We are coming to the end of our time together today. So maybe if folks are out there listening are looking for your recommendations for what to go see this weekend before the Oscar nominations come out, what would you point to, Steve?
Well, my three on my list that'll be on our website are Call Me By Your Name, Phantom Thread, Small Town Crime, all open today, but I could add 10 more. Three Billboards, I, Tonya.
It's a great time of year for films,
right? Lady Bird,
love
Lady Bird. That's probably my favorite movie of the year is Lady Bird.
It's a great time of year for films. Who wants to go next? Cindy?
Call Me By Your Name, Three Billboards, The Darkest Hour.
Okay.
All right.
Good list.
For me, Call Me, I, Tonya, and let's put the post in there.
Yeah, okay, let's put the post in there. Okay. I want to thank Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker,
sure,
Bob Butler for your great expertise and your good recommendations. And have fun at the movies this weekend. Previous programs are at kcur.org/up-to-date, including my conversation with a former Surgeon General who says that loneliness is the most common health condition among Americans. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. You can follow me at Steve Prasky, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday, animal behaviorist Wayne Hunhausen will answer your pet questions, and we'll look at the effects of gaslighting. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.